Hello and welcome to Wild Time, only here on the Digital Hub FM. Coming to you today from the National Museum of Ireland, there is a talk about the conservation of bats. We are broadcasting on 94.3 FM. We are broadcasting from the Digital Depot, which is on Crane Street, right in the center of the Liberties. And Wild Time is a show that deals with all things wild and natural, meaning animals and nature. So the conservation of bats is one of the things, obviously, that is absolutely worth talking about. So coming up is a footage from a talk that has been held just recently at the National Museum of Ireland. My name is Thomas Janak. I am your host for the next 60 minutes, and of course every Friday between 8 and 9 p.m. If you want to find out more about the show, guests past and present, and upcoming events, please visit www.wildtimeradio.blogspot.com. You can listen to us worldwide using the internet by visiting digitalhubfm.com. That's www.digitalhubfm.com.
Conor Kelleher, Chairman Bat Conservation Ireland.
How long is the Bat Conservation Ireland in operation?
We launched it in 2004. So we're trying to get as many members as possible, but at the moment we're kind of acting as an umbrella group for the bat groups of Ireland, and we're giving the bats the voice that they haven't had up until now. So we lobby the government to actually enforce the legal legislation for their protection, because they are all protected animals.
Okay, but obviously you're not there yet, otherwise you wouldn't be lobbying. What are the main difficulties that you're facing?
The main problems are we have the legislation, but lack of enforcement would be the main problems. Although we're pleased that the new minister, Minister Gormley, is taking things more seriously than his predecessors. So we're living in hope at the moment that things are going to improve quite a lot compared to what they have done in the past. Mm-hmm. So the actual wildlife laws came into effect in 1976, but there's never actually been a prosecution for any bat crime under that law since it was enforced. Okay. Because it's either the penalties are too tiny to be worth taking it to court, or else they've been thrown out before it even got to the state solicitor's office. So what we're trying to do is lobby for increased penalties as well for people who actually break the wildlife laws.
So what are when we talk about penalties, and so that there must be some serious stuff out there, what are the main issues that the bats could face?
Well, the main issues is at this time would be increased development. They're suffering from increased development, where the law is there to protect them during development and new road construction, building developments and that. But what's happening is that sometimes some developers ignore the fact that they have bats on site, and they go ahead and demolish a building with bats in it, whereas in fact they are supposed to actually request and be granted a license to do so. Any bat roost is protected, so they need to get what's called a derogation license from the Habitats Directive, okay, or else they're in breach of the law. But sometimes some developers are very, very good. They do everything to help out, because they like to keep these animals on site afterwards. Mm-hmm. But those that don't, they tend to get off with a slap on the wrist at the moment, and what we want is proper penalties. So as a developer might be working on something that's worth 40 million, and if they get a slap on the wrist and a €1,000 fine, that's nothing to them. Exactly, yeah.
I know you have to kick off soon with the talk, so could you please tell us how can people get in contact with you guys?
Well, we have a website, and there's a lot of links off of that, but we've got bat groups now in Cork and Kerry, a new one, Meath, Cavan and Dublin, and there's a very good one in Clare and in Galway as well. So they're amassing more interest all the time, but if they contact us through our website, www.batconservationireland.org, all the links are there, and our contact details, and they can give us a shout and see what we can do for them, because we have a lot of surveys for the public participation during the summer months, and they can actually come out. We'll give them training, we'll give them the electronic equipment to be able to hear bats in their own locations, and they can get involved with field work as well.
I would personally probably be interested in doing this.
It's great fun during the summer months, because what we're doing is trying to build up a picture of the actual bat distribution throughout the island of Ireland, north and south. And with that, we need a lot of foot soldiers out there to actually do the work for us. But last year, now we had over 200 volunteers out in the field during the summer actually recording their bats. And you don't need a lot of knowledge about bats. In fact, you don't need anything at all. It's all done automatically. And we give a training for the, say, the Dob Benton's bats survey, which is on the river. But we've also got a car Transex survey, which is all done completely automatically by the machinery we supply. And all you have to do is post off the recording disc afterwards to one of our main members, and they analyze the disc. So you don't have to do anything, just have a bit of fun, that's all.
Okay. Yep. That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Thanks. You're welcome. Most welcome. Talk about bats in Ireland going back about to the mid 19th century. But to put it in perspective for us, what I'm going to do is just give you very briefly in the next 2 or 3 minutes just an overview of bats, just to give an introduction to the actual animals themselves. Now, at the moment around the world, we actually know that there are over 1,100 different kinds of bats, 1,100 different species. That makes them the biggest group of mammals out there after the rodents. Now, they're mammals just like you and I, they've got warm-blooded, and they've got fur in their bodies, and they feed their young on breast milk. They're very similar to humans in that they only give birth to a single young, the ones in Ireland anyway. A couple of species from around the world actually have a pair of twins. But all the ones in Ireland just have a single baby. People say that they're flying mice, but they're actually more closely related to humans than they are to mice. A mouse would be dead in a year and a half, and in that time they can give rise to litter after litter of young, and by the time they die they have produced about 60 descendants, whereas a bat is different. Bats have to be up to 2, 3, 4 years old sometimes to actually have their first baby, and then after that they can actually live a very long time indeed. If they get over the first few years, bats can live up to 20, maybe 30, and in fact into their 40th year as well. So bats are very, very long-lived creatures compared to mice and rats. They're not related to rodents. All these things you hear about bats being flying mice, getting caught in people's hair, living in belfries, and being blind, all of those things are totally untrue. So they're a very interesting group of mammals. Now, bats are the only group of mammals that have learned to fly as well. You'll hear of other things like this North American flying squirrel, sugar gliders, and colugos. Now, they're gliders. They don't actually have powered flight, whereas the bat does. And the bats are fantastic flyers. And the reason being is that they've developed this extra sixth sense called echolocation, we've named it, a type of sonar, so they can actually find their way around in the dark. They emit these sounds out through their nostrils or out through their mouths. The sounds bounce off objects and comes back to the bat, and he picks up the echoes from it with his ears, and he's able to build up a complete picture of his surroundings that way. And it's such a sophisticated system that it allows the bat not alone to tell where it is in total darkness, but it can pick up if there's any insects around, what direction they're flying, how fast they're flying, and whether they're hard or soft-bodied, and if they can eat them and that. So they get an awful lot of information back just using this system. And this system was only identified about 60-odd years ago now, just prior to World War II. So it's not that long ago since we found out how bats were able to find their way around in the dark. Bats have been around a very long time as well. The oldest known bat fossils go back 55 million years, and they're from the fossil beds in Germany and also from Wyoming in the United States. And these are actual bats as we know them today. So we don't have a half bat or a creature giving rise to a bat, so we don't actually know for sure what kind of an animal or creature gave rise to the bats to begin with. We have no creature that's developing bat wings. Because of that, a lot of scientists believe that they had two separate ancestors, because some bats are very like primates and humans, other bats are very similar to shrews and that, so there could be a bit of more research to be done there through genetics and through more fossil finds as well. So at the moment it's a bit of a mystery, but we do know for that they were flying at the time of the dinosaurs, about 100 million years ago, which means they've been around a lot longer than we have. So getting back to our little country here and how it fits in with our bats. Now, at the very start of the 19th century, all that we knew about bats in Ireland is that we had two species. This is one of them, the brown long-eared bat. Now, he's the common species, and so was this little fella, the common pipistrelle. Now, they were known to be present because you couldn't really avoid them. They were everywhere at night, and people came to know them because they lived in people's houses. So there's no actual record of who first identified these two species in Ireland. It's just that they were always here, and it was known about. So early 19th century, we only knew that we had two species of bat in Ireland. Then in 1837 in England, Thomas Bell actually published a book called The History of British Quadrupeds. This book is actually a fairly solid tome, which recounts all the known natural histories of the terrestrial mammals and the sea mammals as well, the cetacea, the dolphins and whales. So it's quite a large volume, but there's a very good bat section in this book. And this was really the reference work at the time from 1837 onwards for several decades. Now within this book he actually covers each of the bat species that were known in Britain at the time. And he includes these cutting drawings as well. Now one of the bats that were included there was the pygmy bat. This was a bat that was discovered in Dartmoor in 1825 by Dr. Leach. And it was included in the book because they thought at the time it was a separate species. And it was subsequently discovered in Dublin in a few years after this, and it was thought to be a separate species in based on Bell's book. But subsequently it was actually dismissed, and I'll tell you a bit about that later on. But from 1825 onwards through about 1837, this little bat did exist, and then it was subsequently dismissed. Now, William Thompson was one of the first Irish naturalists here, a man from Belfast, and he was interested in all kinds of natural history in Ireland, and he published a book towards the end of his life called The Natural History of Ireland in three volumes. Now, he didn't survive to complete the third volume. It had to be finished by his colleagues. But his three volumes are excellent work for the time. And then at this stage, there was only two bats known in Ireland, but this man actually found a third species. In 1838, he discovered Dobbinton's bats while working for the Ordnance Survey, doing surveys up in Derry, he crossed the border into Donegal, and he found a Dobbinton's bat there. It was only a single specimen, but it was sent down to Dublin to the Natural History Field Club for identification. We were blessed in those days because there was a Natural History Field Club in Belfast and one set up in Dublin as well, and this was really the two hubs that were for to coordinate kind of scientific endeavour in the early part of the 19th century for Irish naturalists. They had no other output really. And a lot of these people were just amateur naturalists. They were having day jobs during the day. But a lot of them were geologists, entomologists, botanists as well. And their interest in bats was really a sideline. It's just that they came across these creatures every now and again. And when they did, there were these type of people that tend to write things down and make a note of it. So Dobbinton's bat was found in 1838. So we were up to three species then. But it wasn't until 15 years later before we actually discovered a breeding roost of Dobbinton's bat in Ireland. And this was discovered in Kildare, in Tankerstown Bridge, in 1853 by a Frederick Houghton was his name. And he actually found 35 bats flying out of this bridge at dusk, and like all good scientists of the day, he took out his shotgun and managed to shoot down a couple from the air. And that was the first time they found Dobbinton's bats roosting and breeding in Ireland. So we knew then we had three resident breeding species in the country. Now in 1845, Natura's bat was discovered by Mr. G. Mangan in the scalp area of Wicklow. This is a very similar species to Dobbinton's bat, but instead of feeding over water, it tends to feed in woodlands. It's a spider specialist. This made it four species known in Ireland, and each of these specimens were collected and sent into the field club for retention for future study. Now we had four species of bats up to now, but it's important to realise that 1845 was the beginning of the worst famine that we ever had in Ireland up to that date and since. And it's amazing to think that people are actually interested in bats, let alone getting out there to actually study these creatures during such a terrible time in the country, but they actually did. And during 1845 there was a lot of references and write-ups about bats in this country by a few different naturalists. For instance, Professor McCoy visited the Vale of Avoca in Carrick MacAdam Church. He found a roost of brown long-eared bats, which they knew were here all along. But he got so excited over it that he went into the attic and he managed to collect three milk pails full of these animals for specimens for the newly developing Naturalist Field Club. He got overly carried away with his enthusiasm, obviously. But again, they wanted the specimens. They just saw them at that time for animals to study. They didn't know the word conservation even existed in those days, which it didn't. So it was basically down to pure research in those days. Now in 1845 as well, there was a report by Mr. Hone, H-O-N-E, that there was a bat around with a funny leaf-shaped nose. Now, this wasn't believed or taken up because there was no specimen involved. He said he had seen one, but he didn't have one to prove it. So that was in 1845. So it wasn't until much later that the story about the leaf-nosed bat came around. Meanwhile, in 1852, John Robert Kinahan, who was one of the main scientists and natural historians of the time, who wrote papers on everything from botany, mammals and everything else across the board, he actually found the first whiskered bat in Ireland in 1852 when a cat brought it into a holiday home he was staying in County Clare. But unfortunately, he didn't actually realise it was a new species for Ireland, and he managed to retain the specimen, but he thought it was the common bat, the common pipistrelle as we call it today. So he kept it in a desk drawer or whatever, and it was to remain there for the next 7 years unaccounted for. in the meantime, the bat with the funny nose, the leaf-nosed bat, was actually found in Galway in 1858. It was a Professor William King from Galway, Queen's University as it was called at the time, who actually discovered the bats. But unfortunately for him,
he actually neglected to write it up at the time, so he didn't make a scientific paper of it. He just sat on the evidence. He was a bit tardy. And another gentleman called Mr. Foote actually reported the incident in writing the following year in 1859, and he was credited with discovering the lesser horseshoe bat in Ireland. Now, the lesser horseshoe bat is a very important bat because it's incredibly rare in Europe. It's extinct in Central Europe, and we've happened to have the largest national population in Europe since. So it's a very, very internationally important species for this country. But it's only found down the western seaboard counties from Mayo down to Cork, and it still is. So poor old William King didn't actually get any credit for that, unfortunately. These were actually sent up to Robert Kinahan in Dublin, because he was the authority on bats at the time. William King sent him up some live specimens, and he actually sent it over to Thomas Bell, who wrote the book on the British quadrupeds, for a confirmation over in London. Because at that time, they really didn't have any field guides to go by. They didn't have any internet or any kind of guidebooks or anything that they could actually figure out what these bats were that they were finding. And telling bats apart, even these days, with all our field guides and CD-ROMs and measuring implements and everything, is very difficult. So when you're not used to finding bats and you find new species in that, you just really don't know what you've got. So he sent it over to London to Thomas Bell, and Thomas Bell said, yes, these are lesser horseshoe bats, and it was confirmed by the two of them that they were. But he also actually compared it to a larger species called the greater horseshoe bat in Dublin. Now, we don't have greater horseshoe bats in this country, but they do occur in Britain and across the continent, even though they're after getting much rarer in Britain since. But they're very similar to lesser horseshoe bats, except they're about three times the size. They're much larger animals. But we did have a specimen in Dublin at the time, because the surgeon with the Fort Dragoons, actually, who was fighting in Balaclava over in, or looking after the guys who were fighting in Balaclava in the Crimea, actually brought back a specimen from there and gave it to Kinahan. The specimen was actually killed by a sentry over in Balaclava when he managed to bayonet it at night when he was on sentry duty, so it ended up in Dublin anyway. So he had that to compare it to. So after this, and thanks to Dr. Alexander Cart, who actually brought the specimen back, compared to this, they knew it wasn't greater horseshoe bat, so they knew at that stage that they were up to six species. And they actually had eight dead bats to compare them to. So the national bat collection started off with very meager specimens indeed. So they only had eight specimens at the time. And then it wasn't until 1868 that the next species was actually found in Ireland. Now, these species were there all the time. They didn't actually come in and suddenly turn up. It was just that nobody was actually looking at them. And if bats were found, and they were usually put down as the commons bat, and an awful lot of expertise wasn't available at the time to actually discover which species was out there. So in 1868, Richard Patterson in Belfast actually found one of these bats in a cave near the, what was the name of the place? The Blackstaff River in Belfast. Now, there had been reports of a large species of bat being seen in the Dingle Peninsula in Kerry at the time. Now, this is a much larger species than all the rest we have in this country. It's the biggest bat we have. And again, it's very, very important for Ireland, because in the continent, they actually know this one as the Irish bat, because we have more of these Leicester's bats than any other country in the world. And it's a very rare bat on the continent. And even in Britain, this is a rare species. So the account that there was a large bat being seen on the Dingle Peninsula got up to Kinahan in Dublin, and he proposed that it was a greater horseshoe bat, and he was sure that the greater horseshoe would be found eventually in Ireland, because he thought, because they were on the western side of Britain, that they'd end up being in the western side of Ireland as well. But he was wrong in that case, and it wasn't until Richard Patterson actually sent him the specimen from Belfast that he identified this bat as probably the large bat that was found down in Dingle as well. So that was Leicester's anyway. So we were up to seven species of bat then, and it was remained at seven for the next 160 odd years, up to the 1990s. So most of those old books, and the books from the 50s, 60s and 70s, would say we have seven species of bats in Ireland, but we know these days. Now, in 1874, Thomas Bell wasn't happy about the book that he had written in 1837, so he decided, with all the new information and all the new work by the naturalists both in Ireland and in Britain, that an update was necessary. So he actually brought out a second edition in 1874, and this updated the bat section. He completely rewrote it, And because he rewrote it, they had dismissed the existence of the pygmy bat at this stage since 1838, since it was discovered, since 1825. And he'd wrote it out of the book completely, so it didn't exist anymore. But this became the next source of reference for any bats that were found in Ireland or submitted to the National Bat Collection from then on. So when the National Museum was set up, the Dublin Naturalist Field Club actually submitted all their samples to the museum then. And these are to be found outside in Beggar's Bush Barracks now, where the behind-the-scenes samples from all different types of fauna, flora and fauna are out there for researchers to dip into. So the bats kind of got a backseat then for the latter half of the 19th century, and due to politics and that in Ireland. And they made an appearance every now and again in political journals and in Punch magazine and that, like this one in 1894. But again, even at this stage, bats started getting a bad name, and you could see they were depicted as evil creatures, and the British rule was the evil bat coming in, and they gave them the head of the Prime Minister at the time. And then the following year, then the Irish Nationalists got their own back and portrayed, the British got their own back and portrayed the National League as the evil one, the evil bat again, and gave them the face of Parnell. And so it was to remain. So bats, even at that stage, were getting a really bad name from the public, because they still didn't know how they were able to get around the dark, and they thought they were very mysterious creatures and thought they were evil. And then to add insult to injury, just when you think things can't get any worse for the poor old bats, along comes the Dubliner, and he decides to write the book of the century nearly. So he wrote Dracula, happily published it in 1897, and the rest, as I say, is history when it comes to bats. And we've been trying to offset the Dracula image of bats ever since, those bat people. However, during this time, there were several naturalists in Ireland, botanists, entomologists, and general zoologists, and they were actually dipping into bats every now and again when they came across them. So there was a few papers being published by various people in the Irish Naturalist, as it was called, the journal at that stage. This was then developed into the Irish Naturalist Journal, which is still publishing scientific papers today. A lot of these people are well-known people in other fields, like R.J. Usher was actually a geologist who discovered the hyena remains in Mammoth Cave down in Cork. But because he used to go in looking at these old fossilised bones in that in caves, he used to encounter bats as well. So as an offshoot of that, he has published papers on bats as well at the time. But there were other people as well, E.C. Barrington and T.A. Coward, Birdman, actually printed stuff on bats as well. H.L. Jameson was another one. He actually brought bat specimens in and donated them to the National Museum. J.R. Kinahan kept on writing papers during this period as well. Nathaniel Alcock was another one. So there's a good few Irish naturalists that actually at some time or other did actually have a look at these bats. Now, the Natural History Museum collection started to come together big time during those years. And this is a cabinet today full of alcohol bottles with species and specimens, not just from Ireland, but from Britain and across Europe and across the world now. Today, there's about 300 specimens in the cabinet and the various drawers. Some are dried and some are held in alcohol. And these are available for scientists and researchers to actually have a look at these animals and study them in hand. Now, it's a fantastic time capsule to have these things going back to the late or mid-19th century. So I had a recent look at these animals. I spent 3 days in the Natural History Museum going through these animals and trying to see which specimens we had. Now, the problems I came across was that, again, the earlier naturalists had to do what they did with very little information or guidelines to go by. So some of their identifications were actually wrong as we know them today. Because they had no photographic records to actually compare the bat to or anything, most of the bats were actually compared to type specimens held in other museums, for instance, in London and that. So what they did is that they found a bat, for instance, G. Dobson, the well-known naturalist, and brought a bat back from Algeria in 1887. And this was compared to a bat over in the London Natural History Museum. And it keyed out as the most coloured bat, Vespertilio murinus, at the time. So that was grand. He brought it up to Dublin and it got the name Vespertilio murinus. Now, two other specimens of that bat were actually brought in subsequently. This is actually Vespertilio murinus as we know him today. It's a European species, not found in Britain and Ireland, and it's called the parti-coloured bat. No, it's not called the most coloured bat, but there is no most coloured bat. It was confused in those days, so they actually mixed up the scientific names as well. But what happened was the specimen that was brought to Dublin then was used as a type specimen for any other species that were found in Algeria or the Eastern Europe, and they were brought in. So Jameson and Usher brought in two more specimens of the same species from Hungary, so Western Hungary and Algeria, in subsequent years, and these were compared to the one that Dobson brought in, and they were identified as Vespertilio murinus, the parti-coloured bat. But unfortunately, they weren't the parti-coloured bat at all. And going through the specimens up in the museum, I was able to rename this as Myosis myosis. It's one of the larger bats in Europe. And so the museum has lost some specimens that they actually thought they had, some species they thought they had, but they've gained others. They didn't know they had any specimen of Myosis myosis. They thought they had Vespertilio murinus, but they don't have any specimens of that now, unfortunately. And going through the specimens over the 3 days, there were 69 such errors that I found there. For instance, another one was a bat that was discovered or caught and brought home from New Mexico in North America, and this was identified as the Chilean myotis. Now, the Chilean myotis, even these days, is not known outside the country of Chile in South America, so in no way it has ever got up to New Mexico. So I actually had a look at that bat and I keyed it out as the Californian myotis. So a lot of these things are confusing, but the naturalists at the time did a really good job for the actual time they had and for the references that they had. I take my hat off to them, they were brilliant. And who's to say in another 100 years' time that somebody will go through the labels again and say Kelleher got it all wrong. Now, Charles B. Moffat was around at this time as well, and he's one of the best naturalists we had ever in this country. He published numerous papers, over nearly 300 papers, in all different kinds of species and wildlife. But he included a substantial effort in looking at bats, and he published papers on bats from 1897 right up to 1938 in the Irish Naturalist Journal. So he's like the father of real proper bat work in this country. Now, from the late 1930s up until the 1950s, not much happened in bats in this country, mainly because there were rough days. It was just after the War of Independence and the Civil War, and World War II came along then as well, so people just weren't looking at bats at all. But John Leslie up in Monaghan, in Castle Leslie, decided to bring in a species from England. So he tried to introduce the greater horseshoe bat, which at this stage was known not to be in Ireland. It was absent. So he went over to England and he brought back a male and a female, and he released them up in the grounds of Castle Leslie in Monaghan, hoping that they'd breed and reproduce them and settle down here. But it isn't like that with bats. Bats only have a single baby, as I said, and you need a lot more than just two specimens to actually make a colony. So there's no surprise that this didn't actually work. So that was about the only bat work prior to World War II. After World War II in the 1950s, a Dutch man on the left there, André Clasens, actually moved to Ireland for a short while, and he was an entomologist, and his main interest in life was fleas. So he decided to look into the fleas of bats in Ireland, and he wrote up several papers on these seminal stuff that wasn't happening before. But also during this time, the late 1950s, around 1958, the Belfast Natural History Field Club actually invited a British bat worker over to Ireland to give a 3-day course in Down on the study of bats, and they went out and they searched caves for bats as well. This is probably the first bat workshop ever held in Ireland. Now, the person they invited over was Michael Blackmore, and they knew him because he was stationed in Northern Ireland during the war as a British soldier. And while he was here stationed in Ireland, he actually was interested in bats, so he actually did the first survey of Leisler's bat across the Ulster province, and he recorded an awful lot of that. So they knew him in Ulster, and when he left the army and retired, he actually wrote some books in England on bats, and he was invited back to host this workshop at the end of the 1950s. And through him and people like Clasens, who went on to encourage people like Stanley Skillen to get interested in bats and do their research, bat work started increasing again in Ireland slowly. It wasn't until then that Professor James Fairley in the 1970s moved from Belfast down to Galway to take up a post in the zoology department of National University of Ireland in Galway. And he was really a seminal influence at that stage in the 1970s on the bat work in Ireland, because he encouraged an awful lot of his students to actually get involved in bats and to do research on them. Now, this man is responsible for writing papers on everything from bag foals and mice all the way up to whales. So, I mean, he's a fantastic naturalist, and thankfully these two gentlemen are still around with us. Unfortunately for Ireland, Andrew Classen's moved out again in the early 60s, and he settled in South Africa. And since moving down there, he's published a load of papers on the local Lepidoptera, the moths and the butterflies of South Africa. So our loss was their gain, really. James Fairley is still here, but he's retired now and moved back to Belfast again. But he has encouraged people to actually get into bat work in the 1970s. In 1976, then, the government brought forward the Wildlife Act, which for the first time ever made all bats in Ireland protected by law. So it was illegal to actually harm them. And subsequent to that, they started a national bat survey throughout the country by their own staff, park staff from the Forest and Wildlife Service at the time. Paddy O'Sullivan was actually hired to actually run this survey for 3 years. And he actually managed to get a bat on the Lady H.O. with Gay Byrne at the time as well to promote it and get people interested in it. That was a very good survey, and they amassed an awful lot of information, because up to that time, even though we knew we had 7 bats in the country, we just had no idea where they were living, what types of places they were living in, what the distribution was, what the populations was, or anything like that. So he roamed around the country trying to amass this information. Then in 1990, Dr. Kate McKinney, who was a student of James Fairley's in Galway, actually went on and to become the first bat officer in Ireland hired by the Office of Public Works. And her remit was to promote bats for the public. So she gave bat walks and talks and promoted their image to try and offset this evil image that they had, and to tell people that these animals were worth saving, and to report any of the roosts that they had in their houses as well. So that was a very important step by the government to try and promote bats. And then in 1996, we actually discovered our 8th species. It was north of the border, it was first discovered. It's one of the pipistrelles, it's called Nethusius. And it was discovered by Mike and Lynn Rendell and Angela Ross near the shores of Loch Ness on September 9th, I think, 1996. We don't know if this species had always been here, but it was more likely that it moved into the country subsequent to global warming, because this is one of the most migrant species in Europe. It often travels maybe 1,500 kilometres from Russia down to France, and we know that they move from Scandinavia down to Scotland as well in the autumn. So if they just miss Scotland, they'd end up in north of Ireland. So since that time, 1996, we've actually discovered more roosts around the Northern Ireland border, around the border counties, both sides, and we've got about 14 breeding sites up there now. And specimens of this bat have actually been picked up and recorded in Cork, Kerry, Tipperary, Dublin as well. They're within Phoenix Park as well here. So they are cropping up every now and again. So they put down roots here, but whether they were here for hundreds of years or not, we just don't know. I imagine they've come sooner than that, or more recently. Then to confuse things even more, in 1997, bat workers were always saying that there was a bit of oddity between the pipistrelles, the common pipistrel, that it we found some roots with dark individuals and others with kind of ginger fur. They were sounded different on bat detectors as well. One had a higher voice than the other. And we started calling them by different names. We called them brown pipistrelles, and we called them banded pipistrelles, and all this sort of thing. But in 1997, geneticists actually got a hold of some specimens, took some biopsy samples off them, and did some genetic tests on these. And they discovered that the common pipistrelle was actually two different species. And they were so far apart genetically, they said it was like comparing a dog to a deer. So at that stage, they decided they'd have to give back a name. So they went back to all the records. And this is the smaller of the species. The new bat that was found was a small bat. And they gave it the name Pipistrellus pygmaeus. And they went back all through the records, right back to 1825, when Dr. Leach found the first specimen over in Dartmoor, and they resurrected it again. So he was around all the time when we didn't realise it. So we gave him a new name then. We called him the soprano pipistrelle, because his voice is higher than the lower common pipistrelle on bat detectors. Other people call it the pygmy bat or the midge bat as well. So after dismissing it and writing out of his book in 1874, poor old Thomas Bell would have to write it back in again these days. So we were then up to 9 species, so things were looking good. Now at this stage, Nine species is a fabulous amount of bats to have in Ireland, because we're so far off the coast of Britain and Europe that most of these species are Mediterranean species, so we're right on the limit of their extreme distribution to the north and to the west, so we're lucky to have any bats in Ireland at all. For instance, Iceland, which is further off the coast, doesn't have any. So we're lucky now, we're up to nine species. And we know with climate change, a lot of the bats are actually moving northwards into now warmer countries, and we could end up with a few more, I think. Now, in 1997 to 2004, the Vincent Wildlife Trust hired Dr. Kate McKinney as well to act as supervisor for these surveys that they undertook in the six counties along the western seaboard where the lesser harsher bat was known, to try and locate their maternity roosts with the object of finding out what the population was and also if they could purchase the building so as they could look after them and preserve them for posterity. Now, these are very loyal species to their roosting sites. Once they find the building, they stay there for decades, if not hundreds of years. So once they found these buildings and bought them, they actually renovated them and turned them into a nice safe haven for the bats. And the Vincent Wildlife Trust now has 14 of these sites down along the west coast, and they've spent over £500,000 in this country buying and renovating these properties. At this date, they've actually got 23% of the national population of lesser harsher bat in these reserves, so they're doing a heck of a lot of good. Now, the Heritage Council have also got one reserve as well, which they bought in the late 1990s, and the biggest one ever, so it's about 400 bats in that in the summer. So they've got that as well. So a lot of these sites are actually in protection now, but we have to protect the habitat around there as well. It's not just good enough to protect the building. And this is the Heritage Council site in near Rouen in Clare, the largest bat roost of this species in the country, and they purchased this and it's been totally renovated since as well. Now, it was actually outside their remit to purchase buildings, but as Dukas at the time wouldn't buy it, the Heritage Council stepped in and they bought it and stayed fairly close to it. Now, around this time as well, from 1999 on, bat groups started to be set up in Ireland, in Cork and Kerry. There was one in Dublin since 1989, and that was kept going by a few people who have since moved to Cabin and Meath, and they're setting up bat groups there now as well. And nowadays, there's bat groups set up in Clare and Galway. And these people have really helped the survey of bats and study of bats in Ireland, because it's a lot more foot soldiers, you get a lot more information back in. So we've got a whole tribe of people out there that can go out and look under bridges and buildings and look for bats now. You don't need licenses for any of this to be inspecting places to find the bats. So we're getting an awful lot more information, and people's interest in these animals are growing all the time. And this is a hibernation site that the Cork Bat Group found only last year in Cork, with over 100 lesser horseshoe bats that was never found before. It was just totally unknown, so it's a good finding. So these bat groups are really, really important. Just a synopsis of the National Lesser Horseshoe Bat Database, which was put together by the government in 2003. This collated all the information known on this species going back 30 odd years. You can see in the 1970s here, in the six counties that the bats actually inhabit, that there was only 18 bats known in Clare in the 1970s. There was only 210 known in Galway and 18 in Limerick. So the total number of lesser harsher bats in the country at that time known was 246. And you can see how our knowledge, thanks to the National Bat Survey here by Paddy Sullivan in the 1980s, increased this up to nearly 4,000 bats. And by 2000, we're up to 9,040 now in the summer months. So we've now got over 700 roosting sites of these animals logged on a national database to know where they are. And then we can see about protecting these animals even better. Once we know where they are, we can look after them. And this database is being added to every week practically. And then when we thought we discovered all the bats in Ireland, in 2003, Enda Mullen, conservation ranger down in Wicklow Mountains National Park, was walking by a newly painted picket fence one day when she saw a bat was stuck to it. She managed to peel it off the paint, but unfortunately it died the next day, despite being cleaned up. And she had her doubts about it. She hadn't seen a bat like this before, so she thought it was what's called a Brandt's bat. So it was sent over to London to the Bat Conservation Trust over there, to Tony Hudson, their bat species specialist, and he confirmed it as a Brandt's bat. We've got an Ireland now, so we're up to double figures at least, and I still think there's one or two out there that we haven't found yet even. So we've gone up to 10 species now, which is remarkable for an island off the coast of Europe. This specimen is sitting over in Beggar's Bush at the moment in a jar of alcohol as well, for anybody in 100 years to view it. Since we found this one, we've got three or four more records of this throughout the country now in Clare, in Tipperary and Kerry as well. So they have been showing up, but we have no breeding roots of this species to date as yet. Now we set up Bat Conservation Ireland in 2004 as an umbrella organisation to give the voice to both the bats and also to the independent bat groups. So they're all affiliated to Bat Conservation Ireland, and we can speak with one voice now. Now, Bat Conservation Ireland set up a national bat database, which is, you can go onto the website for it, which I'll give you at the end. And this is a compilation of bat distribution records from throughout the country. And we're hoping to combine this with the national data, biodiversity data record centre in Waterford as well. So we've both got all the records and the bats from now on going into the database. So we actually know where all our species are and build up our knowledge of them that way. But during the summer months, we've also set up a bat helpline for roost owners who may have difficulty in bats or maybe find a bat in their bedroom some night or something like that, and that they'd have to contact somebody to sort it out for them or something, just to give them some advice so they have somebody to contact during the peak season of bats, which is from March to the end of September. We also run several surveys for the public to get involved with volunteers. One of these is the Dobbinton's Bat Survey, that one that was found by William Thompson in 1838 up in Donegal. It's now known that it's in every county in Ireland. It's a very common species. They roost generally under these masonry bridges and in trees. But we got volunteers out last year to actually survey these animals in the local water bodies near their houses. And we thought we might reach a number of about 50 volunteers after about 5 years. But in the first year of it, we've already totaled over 200 people who are out there checking these animals out. So it's really, really positive that the interest is there to do it. And we supply the training and we also supply the equipment as well. So there's nothing for the people to do except to go outside if there's a nice warm summer's evening. We also run the car transect survey, which is a kind of automatic survey, which is done by car, where a 60 kilometre transect is driven over 4 hours, and the equipment is attached to the passenger side window of the car, and it records all the bats that pass by in ultrasound, which we don't have to hear. You could have the radio on if you wanted, you can listen to the bats if you want, but you don't need any knowledge of bats whatsoever to do this. Just drive around. It's recorded into a mini disc on a mini disc recorder, and when you're finished, you stick it into the supplied envelope that we gave, the stamped addressed envelope, and you just post it off to one of our scientific people who analyse the data on a computer, and they can pick out which bat species pass by the car at night time. So we've built up loads and loads of information. Now the reason we're doing this is not alone just to find out where the bats are and how they're doing, but over 10 to 15 years, if we continue this survey, we'll be able to tell whether the bat population is increasing or decreasing. And it'll give us some alerts, just like the Countryside Bird Survey would. It'll give us amber alerts and red alerts whether the bats are doing well or not. And we have other surveys planned this year. We'll be piloting woodland service for woodland species. Bats are a bit more difficult, so we'll be announcing those on our website as well. Now, we set up training workshops throughout the year as well. We do detector workshops to get people using these little handy bat detectors that we have now that you can actually use to tell the different species apart when they're flying around. Handling workshops as well for anybody who's interested in training up for a government license to be able to capture and handle bats for scientific research or whatever. We also are trying to promote the development of bat groups in different counties as well, so we'd support them through supplying them with literature, talks and that as well to get them off the ground, and posters and whatnot, whatever they need. Yeah, sorry. We also run the National Bat Conference in Ireland, and we lobby the government for better enforcement of the wild effects as well. We've actually run an international fieldcraft workshop in Killarney, which brought in people, bat workers from across the globe, as far away as Australia and the Americas as well. And we actually discovered two new species in Kerry that weekend, Enthusiast pipistrelle and Brandt's bat, which were not known in Kerry before that. So these things are very useful. We also ran the European Bat Research Symposium, which is held every 3 years. This was held in Galway in 2005. It was a week-long event that it brought in specialists and lecturers from across the world again. So Ireland is firmly on the world bat map at this stage as one of the main areas of bat research. Now when it comes to modern Ireland, there's problems with development because there's so much going on out there that the bats haven't got time to actually adapt fast enough to cope with the changes in their environment. So we're a bit worried about that because the scale of it is just so huge. There's all different kinds of development done out there, and taken separately it doesn't add up to much, but when you put it all together, that's a hell of a lot of concrete going down there. And we do know that wind farms and that can chop up bats that are migrating in other parts of the world, but we have no idea on migration of bats in this country, whether they're doing it or not, and whether they're getting killed by these things or not. So we need to investigate that yet. Now, we've got positive conservation out there, all right, because we've got a lot of guidelines to go by now. We do environmental impact assessments and surveys. If you want to handle bats or knock down a building with bats or anything like that, you have to apply for a license from the government to actually do so legally. So there is laws in place to protect these animals. If things, developments have to go ahead, then we mitigate for the bats on those sites and make sure that the bats are retained as much as possible so they can continue to live with the development as well. It may threaten the success of some species, like the lesser horseshoe bat, for a couple of reasons. Like the 700 roosts that we have on record at the moment, I've gone through all those to see what building materials they're actually built from, and I discovered that only 30 of those 700 are built with modern blocks. All the rest are old stone buildings, so it's obvious that the bats don't like modern building materials, and only 5 of them actually had tiled roofs, so it doesn't bode well. So hopefully they'll be able to adjust in the next 50 or 100 years to be able to use these materials as well, but we just don't know how they're going to cope with the new building materials. Now, things weren't all good in the last few years either, because bats again had a bad name through bad publicity. We remember the Gamma scandal, where this company were practically employing their Turkish workers on slave labour, diverting their wages into a slush fund off the coast. And this was one of the cartoons that ended up in one of the magazines. And you can see that they don't give a damn about the workforce, but they built a €100,000 bat house down in Ennis to look after the bats, all right. And I mean, for mitigation purposes, it was required, but put this way, it does look like they don't care about their staff, but they'll do look after the animals, all right, and that's not what we're about. When we're building bat houses like this, I'd like to think that we only use them where it's totally necessary, and that we don't put them in places where they'll end up as being white elephants. That's not the purpose. The whole point of conservation should be on a common sense level. Bat planning during road schemes, I've only got 5 minutes to go on, I think. Road schemes in that we've developed different guidelines for the NRA, with the NRA I should say, and they published them themselves. They brought out these guidelines for their own engineers and that to follow, where we once were only surveying bats for a couple of nights during the summer months during their active period on these huge road schemes. We are now doing 4 seasonal surveys to find out what the bats require in spring, what they're doing in the summer months, and when they're mating in the autumn months, where they need to actually set up their mating sites, and also we include their hibernation sites in the winter as well. So it's a totally new philosophy, and it's all written up by the NRA in their own guidelines, so they really do have to follow these. Because if you're going out doing a 2-day or 2-night survey on a road that's 80 kilometres long, it's not going to do the bats much good. But if you do it over 4 seasons, and there's plenty of time between the planning of these things and the actual construction to fit in the bats into the overall planning, then it will work for the bats, all right. So we go up to the countryside like this, and we walk it looking for the habitats for they're suitable for bats. Water bodies like this will attract water favouring bats like soprano pipistrelles and dobentons. Hedge lines will be used by pipistrelles. You get woodland species down here, and then you get larger species like leisure bats and maybe brown long-eared bats and other pipistrelles as well, living in people's buildings. And what we do is we try to go out in at night and figure out what they're doing in the countryside. The smaller bat species would actually be following the hedgerows, like we'd use highways to get across the countryside. Larger species like leisures will fly across the open landscape here, and the water-based species here will be zipping along over the canals or in drainage channels and into ponds. And when we find out that data over the 4 seasons, we can then actually mitigate for them, and we can put flyovers like this to make sure that they can get over the roads without being hit by the traffic and that. Or we might put underpasses in as well for the bats to get across. Instead of putting one in a case like this here, if there's a bridge going in here, we just take out the hedgerow that was actually along here, put in a new hedgerow down here, and this is enough to divert the bats away from the road crossing point here and bring them under the bridge, and then we connect it back up to the hedgerow that they're on the other side as well. Because the smaller bat species don't like crossing open territory because they have to have something to keep their bearing. Now, National Parks and Wildlife Service have actually brought out the bat mitigation guidelines for Ireland at the end of last year as well. And this is guidelines for the building construction firms, for householders as well, what they can actually do to safeguard bats in the buildings that are being demolished or being renovated or being newly built are actually things to do to attract bats into buildings that they're building for the future, to make them more bats friendly. Now, we've never had it so good when it comes to bat research in this country or any other country, because unlike the old days of the 19th century, we've got the battery of modern technology to actually look into these creatures. So we've got all bat detectors and these recorders and all kinds of gadgetry to actually look into and study these animals. So we put these little tags on bats' wings with numbers on them so we know how long they're living and how often they're breeding as well. We've got these tiny radio transmitters as well that we can attach to the back of a bat, which give off a signal, and we can then follow the bat around the countryside with the receivers, listening on the bleeps, bleeps, bleeps for maybe 8 or 9 days to find out how they're going around the countryside and find other roosts as well. So we've got a whole battery of toys that we can play with these animals now. But bat study is still in its infancy, and the more questions, the more we study these animals, the more questions arise, so we just can't answer everything at the moment. So I don't believe there are any bat experts out there, because we're all only know so much, we're only specialists. We haven't got a clue of what these animals really are doing out there. It's a bit different at the moment. Now, on top of all this, we're inundated with literature on bats and field guides and everything, so we've loads of reference material out there. So there's loads of stuff to tap into on the internet and everything else. Now, back to the Natural History Museum Bat Collection, just finally. This is a fantastic resource for people like myself going in there, not just on bats, but every other kind of specimen and creature they've got out there behind the scenes, not just the stuff that's on show or was on show up until recently, the accident down in Merrion Square. These animals are going back years and years, so it's really good for UCD students like who are doing genetic studies, and they're sitting in the back of the room here, so I'd better mention them, on these animals, so they can go into these specimens and actually take biopsy samples and do the testings over in their lab in UCD to find out where the history of Irish bats really come from. Were they here before the Ice Age? Did they come into Ireland afterwards? What species they're related to across Europe as well, and where their origins are from. Now, we don't have all the bat species that were collected way back in the early days, unfortunately. The oldest specimen I came across in the Natural History Museum was in 1861. It was one of Kinahan's own specimens. Prior to that, the specimens seemed to have disappeared. And this may have been as a result in the 1930s of a leak in the roof. Water got into the roof of whatever building they were in, and it actually flooded the drawers where the bats were kept. And it wasn't actually discovered until the 11th of November 1964. So there was no real interest in looking at these animals, obviously, during those days. But in 1964, they realised there was a problem because some of these specimens were covered with fungus. But they decided to ignore it for some reason up until August 1985, when they finally opened the drawer again and had a look at them. And they were too far gone. And they decided these animals were just a danger to other specimens in the museum, so they threw them out. And these could have been the very earliest specimens that we had of Dogbenches bats from Donegal. But apart from that, the specimens that are there now are in very good condition. And if anyone ever finds any bats, send them to Bat Conservation Ireland, send them on to me. I love getting bats in the post. It's great. If you find any dead ones, I'd like to have a look at them first, identify them, and then I'll ship them up to the Natural History Museum. I've already shipped about 70 specimens up there to add to it. But make sure you don't post them on a Friday, because they'll be a bit smelly, by Monday. And don't put them through a Frankie machine as well, because they come out a bit flat on the other side. Now, UCD at the moment and UCC in Cork are actually tendering for to become an Irish centre of excellence for bat study in this country. And the tenders are into the government for that at the moment. So we've come a long day from away from the early days of poor old William Thompson back in the 1830s. Now, people's attitudes towards bats are changing as well, because they're beginning to realise how useful these animals are. A bat will eat about 3,500 midges per night every summer. And during the summer season. And this is a bat roost down in Kerry. The homeowner was so happy with his bats when he was renovating this building. He actually had 4 species living in here, but he preferred the brown long-eared bat, Lycotis auritus, and he decided to make up a lovely limestone carving entrance for the bats, just to leave them in and out of his house, so they're welcome. So hopefully this is a sign of things to come, and people will appreciate these animals more in the future than in the past. So thanks for listening. If you want any more information, please give us look up our website. There's loads of links there, and you can contact myself as well if you have any dead bats. I obviously don't handle any dead animals. It's not very nice in here, but pick them up with tissue or tea towel or anything like that. Stick them in a jiffy bag and post them down to me. I don't mind. Postman might not like it, but I don't mind. Thanks very much for listening.
Well, that certainly was very, very interesting. That's all we have time for. You're listening to Wild Time here on the Digital Hub FM 94.3. My name is Thomas Janak. That's all for this week. Please listen in again next week between 8 and 9 p.m. Until then, bye-bye.